supporting WHYY Penn Medicine, helping to find new cures for cancer. With life-saving clinical trials and advanced surgical techniques, Penn Medicine is offering more hope for patients everywhere. Learn more at PennMedicine.org/cancer. Penn Medicine, what's next?
While recovery stagnates in Puerto Rico, life is getting better for hurricane evacuees in Philadelphia. I'm Dave Heller, and this is NewsWorks Tonight. After the storm destroyed the island almost 8 months ago, 900 families came to the city, many of them without houses, jobs, or even food. Some 60 families are still in extreme need, and local organizations finally have plans in place to keep them from ending up on the streets. Catalina Jaramillo of WHYY's Plan Philly visited one of the first families that's been able to call a place home again.
Angel Chaparro asks Luis, his 16-year-old son, whether he likes Puerto Rico or Philadelphia better.
Luis, ¿te gusta aquí o allá?
Luis has multiple spine and brain disorders that prevent him from being able to speak. But the answer is he likes it here. Why? His father asks.
¿Aquí? ¿Por qué?
After Hurricane Maria, doctors told Chaparro and his wife Marta to move their son here so he could continue to get the daily medical attention he needs. Luis also needs surgery to drain liquid from his brain, and getting that in Puerto Rico would have been impossible. Since the family moved to this new apartment 2 weeks ago, Luis spends hours looking out the window. They're on the sixth floor and have a beautiful view of Northeast Philadelphia. And from time to time, the regional rail passes by. Luis points out the window.
Por el tren. ¿Sí?
For the train, Luis says, smiling. He likes it here in their new home because he can see the trains pass by. Life with a home is a little easier for the Chaparros, especially because the apartment is adapted to their son's needs.
This was a blessing. It's comfortable, and the bathroom is big, which is great for him.
When they first came back in December, they had raised funds in Puerto Rico to help pay for an apartment. But then the money started running out. Almost 8 months after the storm, about 60 Puerto Rican evacuee families, like the Chaparros, are still struggling to meet basic needs. But now, Philadelphia's Long-Term Recovery Committee has the funds to help them find permanent housing and get settled. It comes after months of pressuring state and local agencies and organizing on the ground. Julia Menso leads the committee. She says things are getting better for the families.
You know, you know where your kids are going to school. You know where you're going to be living 2 months from now. Like, you have some security that you're going to be in the same place for a while. So we're starting to get to that, a little bit of a recovery phase where people are starting to get some sense of normalcy.
Menso says there's still a lot to do. People moving into houses don't have furniture, many of them don't speak English, and haven't been able to secure a job to buy groceries and pay for bills. But a stable address is the first step out of the crisis. For the Chaparros, it was an apartment in one of the Philadelphia's public housing developments. Luis's mom, Marta, says having a home gives them the space to take care of themselves.
Here you are, how do you say, private. It's comfortable for the kid, too. He wakes up whenever he wants. When he wants food, I cook for him. It's not like staying in a shelter or a hotel.
The committee hopes to house the rest of the families by the end of June. Catalina Jaramillo, WHYY News.
Chances are that sound has been ringing in your ears for the past few weeks, or maybe you've been the one doing the sneezing. You've possibly noticed a decent bit of yellow powder on your car as well. Well, it's not just you. It's been an unusually bad season for allergy sufferers. There's more pollen in the air than normal for this time of year, and unfortunately, it may not get much better anytime soon. To put this season in perspective, I paid a visit this morning to Dr. Donald DeVorin. He's an allergist at the Asthma Center in Mount Laurel, New Jersey, and does a daily count of how much pollen is in the air and what kind.
Anyway, this is what I do every morning. I collect a slide.
A machine on the roof of his office collects the pollen each day. In the 90s, Dr. DeVorin and his team published a study on which pollen-producing plants affect allergy sufferers in the Philadelphia region, and today, you can find daily counts of each of those pollens on the Asthma Center's website.
So doing the forensics, looking back, what weather conspired to have this onslaught?
This onslaught, yeah, we actually saw an overlap for the early pollinating trees and the late pollinating trees this year. And we believe it's that March weather, that horrible snowfall that we had on multiple occasions. And that delayed the pollination of the trees by approximately 10 days. That's what we estimate.
For how long have you been doing these counts?
30 years. I've been doing this since, believe it or not, I came to Philadelphia in 1985.
That you've been doing this for 30 years, you know, with weather, they have this term like the storm of the century. Is this 2018 spring the allergy storm of the past 30 years that you've been doing this, or does it wax and wane?
It waxes and wanes, but this is definitely more than 5 years. This is higher than the last 5 years, I can tell you that. When I came here in the mid-80s to 90s, we had some tremendous pollen counts back then, especially ragweed, which is fall. The ragweed, which goes in the fall, has actually dropped off somewhat, you know, but the tree pollen continues to climb.
That's exploding.
Especially with global warming, we really feel there's a basis for it, because we now see some trees in the fall and we see some grass coming in the fall as well as the spring. That's something I didn't see before about 10 years ago, and it's increasing every year.
Dr. DeVorn, let me have a look through the microscope.
I see. Now, I see various stains.
Yes, the staining is representing the pollen. Yeah.
The slide shows large red dots and even larger black and white dots.
But the middle area is like a Mickey Mouse look to it, where the pine pollen. So you see it's at least double the size or triple the size of oak. And the reason why pine penetrates the Philadelphia area is because, you know, it floats. It floats so well.
Yes.
Those are air bladders that you're looking at on the sides of the pollen. So they can go for hundreds of miles, actually.
Stepping up onto the roof, Dr. DeVorn showed me the pollen counter. It's a motorized weather vane-like contraption, which whirred in the background as we talk.
Yeah, this is the machine. The machine is called the Burkard Spore Trap. It's Burkard, B-U-R-K-A-R-D, the fellow that invented the machine from England. So I will open this up for you so you can see it. So we fix this and then open it. So you get an idea not only of the amount, the total amount, but the time of day that the pollen is being deposited. So you get an idea of when the pollen comes out, which is usually the morning and usually late afternoon.
So it's interesting. We touched on taking a longitudinal view over your now 30 years doing this. You were saying early on, like in the 80s, there were some pretty harsh years.
Yes.
And now here we are again, and you're suggesting the interplay with climate change. But what? How do you make that correlation?
We feel that the extension of the seasons by the warming trend has allowed the trees and the plants to pollinate longer. In other words, if you get into your seasons more condensed, you will shut down the pollen production. We're delayed this year by about 10 days. We've noticed that since the March season was so late.
So just how long will the surge in pollen last?
I expect by middle of next week, we may be through the main part of the tree pollen season, which is this oak pollen. However, our pine pollen may last until June. And we're right at the edge of the pine lands in this location. So our pine pollen is going to surge any day now.
The good news, says Dr. DeVorn, is that there are more medical remedies for allergy sufferers than ever before, with even more on the horizon. But he says the best prevention is to stay indoors as much as possible on days when the air is thick with pollen. Poor sections of Wilmington, Delaware have been ravaged by violent crime in recent years, making it one of the most dangerous cities in America on a per capita basis. But 1 year ago, when new mayor Mike Perzicki hired a police chief with more than 3 decades of experience in New York and Chicago, both of them pledged to work tirelessly to create a more peaceful city. WHYY's Chris Barish reports that so far, the results are promising.
By this time in 2017, 74 people had been shot on Wilmington streets. But so far this year, that number is only 27. That's a 64% decrease and the lowest number through May 9th in at least a decade. Homicides and robberies are down substantially too. Chief Robert Tracy credits a transformation to a force that uses statistical analysis to target the most violent offenders, intervenes to prevent retaliatory shootings, and interacts better with the community.
I know we're working very well together, and when things start to gel, as they are now, these are the type of results you're going to see. And, you know, this is too early to start declaring victory. This is just something to build off of, and we can even get better. There's going to be some bad days. This didn't get like this overnight in Wilmington. And, you know, it's going to take a while to come back to where we need to be, where everybody feels safe.
But in the Hilltop section that has seen more than its share of bloodshed, barber Jose Natal says he's surprised the numbers are down.
There was a shoot on Broome Street 2 weeks ago. Apparently last night they found a guy dead from a gunshot wound to the head. I remember them talking about they would be more involved with the community or do more foot patrols, and never seen that happen.
Chief Tracy counters that the force is committed to being partners with and guardians of the public. From the Delaware desk, Chris Barish, WHYY News.
Natural gas has been touted as a bridge to a clean energy future, and it's replaced coal as the country's top power source. But it's also causing problems for another source of energy, nuclear. For State Impact Pennsylvania, the Allegheny Front's Reed Frazier reports that this could be a setback in the fight against climate change.
It was just four short years ago when an American president said this about natural gas.
If extracted safely, it's the bridge fuel that can power our economy with less of the carbon pollution that causes climate change.
President Obama's prediction was partially right. Hundreds of coal plants have closed. But now something else is happening, too. Inside the Three Mile Island nuclear plant, a reactor creates enough electricity to power 800,000 homes. But the plant is slated to shut down next year. Inside a control room, shift manager Nick Favorito says he hopes that doesn't happen.
We're hopeful that we'll work with the PA legislature to find a solution to keep these plants running, since they are carbon-free source electricity, a large carbon-free source electricity.
But that could be tough for the plant's owner, Exelon. The plant can't make money in an electricity market flooded by cheap natural gas. Researcher Jesse Jenkins says that's a bad thing for the climate.
So if your concern is about climate change and you view it as an urgent and perhaps even existential threat to human society and to the environment, then you should be very concerned about the closure of nuclear power plants. And indeed, it's the thing that keeps me up most at night right now.
Jenkins is a PhD candidate at MIT who studies ways to lower the carbon footprint of the electric grid. He says nuclear plants around the country are retiring much sooner than they have to. In addition to Three Mile Island, First Energy announced it was closing three of its nuclear plants in Ohio and Pennsylvania. Jenkins says each of these are large sources of carbon-free electricity that'll probably be replaced by natural gas, which emits CO2, though not as much as coal.
And losing each one is a significant step back at a time we should be making rapid progress towards a zero-carbon energy system.
An industry-funded study found the four nuclear plants scheduled to close in Ohio and Pennsylvania provide more emissions-free electricity than all the wind and solar in the entire Mid-Atlantic grid, a region that serves 65 million people. To stay in business, nuclear plant owners are turning to states and federal government for help. First Energy has asked the federal government to declare a grid emergency to keep its coal and nuclear plants running. New York and Illinois are subsidizing their struggling nuclear plants by giving them zero emissions credits. These are basically subsidies the states pay to nuclear plants for the carbon pollution these plants are preventing. Matt Wald is with the Nuclear Energy Institute, an industry trade group. He says policies like these are necessary.
We are seeking to have the market recognize the things that we provide to the system. It doesn't do that now.
Nuclear's precarious situation is a complicated one for environmental groups who have long opposed nuclear energy. Tom Schuster is with the Sierra Club in Pennsylvania. He worries about nuclear's own environmental problems, like radioactive waste, impacts from uranium mining, and the risk of a Fukushima-type disaster. But then again, he thinks about what nuclear plants don't put in the air.
If they're replaced by plants that burn fracked gas, then that's definitely a problem.
Nuclear remains the country's top source of carbon-free electricity. So the Sierra Club supported a nuclear bailout in Illinois that also promoted renewables.
I kind of think about it as thinking about nuclear plant policy as a phase-out rather than a bailout.
The best way to get this to happen, he says, is through a tax on carbon emissions. That would make coal and natural gas more expensive to produce and help carbon-free sources of electricity. But that's not likely at the federal level. So could Pennsylvania bail out its nuclear plants? Maybe. But the state's large natural gas industry opposes any bailout for nuclear, and there are no bills in the legislature that would do so right now. Reed Frazier, State Impact, Pennsylvania.
The Barnes Foundation in Philadelphia has a special exhibition of work by Pierre-Auguste Renoir and his son, the French filmmaker Jean Renoir. The elder Renoir is a cornerstone of the Barnes collection, which sometimes attracts mockery. A lot of people don't like Renoir. As part of this new exhibition, the Barnes Foundation is acknowledging the backlash by offering a lecture this weekend entitled Why We Love to Hate Renoir. The talk will be given by the foundation's deputy director, Martha Lucy. WHYY's Peter Crimmins invited Lucy to explain why we hate Renoir and why maybe we shouldn't.
The Barnes galleries are laid out in a series of rooms that you walk through. Some rooms are quite small, some big. And a visitor would walk into a room and look at the pictures, and there might be a lot of Renoirs on the wall. And then you turn the corner, you go to the next room, and there's more Renoirs.
Yes.
And you go to the next room, and there's more Renoirs.
Mm-hmm. It's the biggest Renoir collection in the world. There are 181 works by Renoir, and they are all on view, except one poor lithograph.
And as someone who works at the Barnes, you hear people talk about all those Renoirs that are in there, and sometimes they're not so complimentary, the things that people say.
Yeah, I really started paying attention to what people were saying about the Renoirs when I was working on a Renoir project on the book. I mean, I like to hear what people say in the galleries anyway. It's just kind of fun to go in there and listen. But I started noticing visitors complaining, like, oh, God, all these Renoirs. Like, I can't, you know. There are lots of people who do like Renoir, but I really started noticing that it was just kind of a trend.
And you noticed that it was happening outside of the Barnes, not just the Barnes exhibit.
Yeah.
But across
yes,
the culture.
Yes, it's not just the Barnes. The more I started paying attention to it, the more I noticed that it was everywhere.
Did you come to an understanding why people feel this way?
One thing that I've noticed, there are lots of food metaphors. When people dismiss Renoir, people will say, oh, it's like his work looks like cream puff, or it's like frosting, or these nudes look like croissants, you know, and I feel like they don't really look like cream puffs. It kind of tells you that people associate Renoir with pleasure.
Because these are dessert foods or
well, because they're dessert foods and they're caloric,
foods.
Right? And yeah, they're sweet and sugary, and sweet and sugary is not supposed to be does not suggest serious art. And so if you're a serious viewer of art, it's sort of not fashionable.
There's a reason why there are 181 Renoirs at the Barnes Foundation is because Albert Barnes collected them. He was a very serious guy. And
very serious.
He
yes.
collected his art very seriously, and he had a very definite
yes.
ideas
yes.
about what would be in the collection. And Renoir was very important.
Renoir was super important in Barnes's collection. He's almost sort of the key artist in the collection, I think. He was obsessed with Renoir. At the time that Barnes was collecting, so the 1910s, 20s, and 30s, Renoir was extremely popular.
And popular not because he was pretty or
right.
sweet,
no,
a
exactly.
sweet confectionery.
That's
he was important.
That's an important point. He was considered a masterful colorist, a masterful designer. Barnes felt that he was able to draw on tradition, you know, the classics, sort of the old masters, and kind of update that stuff with a contemporary vocabulary. So he plays a really important role in Barnes's collection. You see him putting Renoirs next to a lot of old masters, kind of showing how he's almost this transitional figure between 17th, 18th century painting and artists like Matisse and Picasso. Mm-hmm.
Well, you're giving a talk this weekend called Why We Love to Hate Renoir. Why do you feel a hatred for Renoir is a misdirection? Turn me around.
Okay, it's hard to do that without sitting in front of one of the paintings. I'd like to kind of point you to certain things. His paintings are more difficult than people realize. I think that they're stranger than people realize, and I mean that in a positive way. There's a lot to grapple with there. There are just these very bizarre kind of distortions of the body where he's kind of playing with perspective and kind of twisting limbs around in a way that almost anticipates Picasso. A lot of painters really love Renoir because he could handle paint like nobody. He kind of uses glazes and builds up these very kind of full-looking forms using thin, thin paint. Technically, he's really an artist worth looking at. Even though his subject matter is repetitive, that's one of the things he's criticized for, and sometimes not very interesting. You know, he's painting a lot of women and landscapes over and over and over again. The way that he's doing it, the way that he's approaching form, it's significant enough that Picasso and Matisse looked to him as a kind of hero. I mean, they really did, you know, and you don't hear about this very much.
I'm speaking with Martha Lucy. She's the Deputy Director of Research and Education at the Barnes Foundation, and she will be delivering a talk this weekend called Why We Love to Hate Renoir. Thanks so much for being here.
Thank you.